You're listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, Asheville's premier soccer podcast.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of You're Smarter Than Us. I'm excited to have with me Darby Lockridge of the Switch the Pitch platform, podcast, and Twitter handle. How are you doing, Darby?
I'm doing excellent. It's fantastic. A good Saturday.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much for coming on with us. Before we get too far down the rabbit hole of what I'm absolutely positive will be a fantastic episode, I have a very bad habit of not starting conversations off with letting people know where my guests are coming from and where they can find them. So real quick, about a month ago or so, I was introduced to you through a conversation that the Soccer Goose put out there through the BGN network. And I still think about that conversation. And I quickly started following Switch the Pitch and has become one of my favorite Twitter accounts. Can you just talk a little bit about Switch the Pitch and what you guys do?
Sure. So Switch the Pitch is an all-female owned and operated kind of soccer media thing, conglomerate. We're actually branching out in a lot of different areas that that we're even kind of trying to keep the lasso around these days. It started out as just a journalism website. There were articles about MLS specifically. We started out originally as MLS Female, and it was MLS from the female perspective. And then just at the first of 2020, we rebranded to be Switch the Pitch, which is, you know, we say we're switching the pitch of soccer media. And after that point, we have launched a podcast. We also are focusing a lot more on kind of visual aspects of the game, which is an absolutely terrifying thing to try to do in 2020 when everything got shut down and we don't have photographers in the stadium anymore. But we do have a bevy of amazing photographers that do really great visual work around the game and things like that. So we, you know, have an Instagram page. We use those photos on our kind of social media and promoting our articles, but are also looking at other ways, and our people that are running the photography side of things are looking for new and exciting ways to use those photos. So I would just say soccer media in general that is women owned currently. I actually did our last podcast, I think that went out 2 weeks ago. We did talk a lot about what being female owned and operated really means and who we consider female, and definitely solidified our view that that goes far past a single gender, because we know that the gender binary is dead. So basically no men. But past that, if you're not the traditional soccer media, we're here with you. So
what are those handles, and where can they find the podcast?
So we are, we podcast through Anchor, and it shows up on most podcast platforms that I've been able to find. So, mm-hmm. iTunes, Spotify, I use Pocket Cast, which is super hippie of me. I've found it all over.
For the Bohemian podcast listeners.
Right, exactly. on Twitter and Instagram, we are Switch the Pitch 1, which is super sad. We had Switch the Pitch right up until that last minute, and then somebody grabbed it out from under us. So we are Switch the Pitch 1 on Twitter and on Instagram. We do have a little bit of a Facebook presence, fb.me/switchthepitch. And our website is switchthepitchsoccer.com.
I implore everyone to check them out. Again, in the past month, they've quickly become some of my go-to handles and accounts for just fantastic coverage. Darby, after the restart of sports in this country, we saw I don't think you could argue that they weren't successful bubble tournaments, both the NWSL and MLS. How do you think each of those went? And do you think they were, or what would you attribute the kind of disparity in viewership between of them, where the NWSL, ratings just kind of went through the roof, slow but steady climb from the CBS All Access regular games into the semis and then the finals, which just went through the roof. And then MLS, which had a similar kind of straight out of the gate improvement in ratings, but then almost weekly that the ratings kind of trickled down and trickled down and trickled down.
Yeah, that was an interesting phenomenon. I loved watching the Challenge Cup. And one of the things that I thought that it really had going for it was the fact that it was absolutely on CBS All Access. So you knew where the games were going to be. It wasn't one of those things where you needed the live soccer TV app to figure out which broadcast mm-hmm. you were going to need. Like you always knew where you could find the games. And I think that level of consistency and that level of being where fans can find you consistently is super helpful. I think that the great irony of the MLS tournament was that it started out all over the place. Like every morning when I wanted to mm-hmm. watch some games, it was like, looking to see what stations I was going to be looking for, what broadcast it was going to be on. And the irony was, is once the tournament kind of settled into a single broadcast provider, that's when people stopped watching. And mm-hmm. I really think that it was a function of people got tired of trying to figure out where they could watch the matches and gave up watching right about the time that MLS figured out that they needed to be consistent and nobody knew.
I can certainly see that. Do you think, and this is just kind of spitballing because I don't know that we had ever seen this on the East Coast before, spoiled, genteel sport fans that we are, where most of the time sports are kind of scheduled literally to our catered taste. But you're having these 10 o'clock at night kickoffs East Coast time for the NWSL bubble tournament in Utah, which I could only imagine was actually a benefit because I know I was staying up and the West Coast was probably enjoying, the finally being able to watch a game at 7 o'clock at night.
Right. It definitely did cater to a different kind of fan. But I think that, here's a big complaint. And here's one of my biases that will definitely come into play. I am a U.S. soccer, but by and large, I'm a U.S. soccer watcher. I watch MLS. I watch NWSL. I watch U.S. women and men. I don't watch a lot of, I'm definitely not an EPL watcher. I have one championship league team that I follow. But I see a lot of the people in the soccer sphere that I hang out with, both digitally, virtually and also in person, that will wake up at the crack of dawn mm-hmm. or will stay up until the middle of the night to watch EPL games or, leagues on the other side of the world. And I think that it was some of those same folks that I saw complaining that like, oh, I've got to stay up so late, or oh, I've got to be up early in the morning and I can't. And I'm like, look, friend, I've seen you up at the crack of dawn at a bar in Houston watching some EPL game. I don't want to hear it out of you.
hold their feet to the fire. Absolutely.
Right.
So Darby, NWSL has made, in addition to their bubble tournament, which was, the successful return of team sports in this country, whether, the majority of the major sports networks and coverage want to admit it. And it, again, the ratings went through the roof. I think there was over 600,000 watching the final, again, on a paid, a centralized over-the-top network channel or a streaming channel. But, that it was successful. It didn't come with a package. I think that's very important. But successful U.S. women's national team victory in the World Cup last year. Everything seems to be trending up, literally to the point where now we're losing some of our NWSL stars to overseas because they're seeing the quality and now they're getting into bidding fights for them. What do you see as the future of the NWSL? Is it trending up? Is it going the direction that you want it to go? Or is it starting to broach, as I've seen a few people suggest, some or Don Garberization of the women's game?
You know, I think that it's an absolutely critical time for the NWSL. In its current iteration, NWSL has lasted 9 years up to this point, right? Mm-hmm. Something akin to NWSL has been around two different other times, and I believe it only lasted about 3 years both times before folding. Mm-hmm. So they have matured to three times their past life, and they're really going to have to start to figure out everything that I look at with soccer is a funnel, right? I don't think that you can look at a league with a snapshot of the people that are playing in it currently. We always have to look at youth programming, how people come up through, because big name players, whether men or women, don't show up overnight. You don't just go knock on a door and say, "Hello, 20-year-old person, have you heard of the sport of soccer? Would you like to play?"
Absolutely.
And so it really is a critical time if NWSL wants to hang on to its players that we have, and if we want to start really becoming in some cases a destination where not only is the flow going one way, are we not losing our players to bigger clubs across the pond, can we be some kind of a draw for players from other places to come over here? Which, mm-hmm. I live in a really odd market where we have the Houston Dash with no U.S. national team players on our roster. And so we actually do have, a number of our star talent does come from other leagues that have come over here to the U.S. And so the Dash have figured out some sort of a recipe to be attractive in some ways, which I think is wild because we're definitely known for not being a club necessarily that domestic players want to come to, but somehow we have been able to draw talent like Rachel Daly and to draw Jane Campbell and, generally speaking to keep them here for a pretty good period of time and to make a home for them here. So I really think that it's going to be critical for NWSL to find a tactic to create domestic players, that create a league that players from all over the world want to come to. It's time to start being competitive now that the market has truly blossomed to be a world market for women's players. It's time for them to do something different. And if they're going to make it past the 10-year mark, they're really going to have to make some changes.
Do you think it's imperative for the national team to divest itself from contracts in the NWSL? Or is that just going to expedite the challenges of roster construction and maybe create a couple years of players choosing to stay overseas instead of coming back?
That's a tough question. And I don't know that I have a great answer. To be honest, I would ask the players to be really honest. If I were the league, this is definitely not my role at all. But if I were the league, I would look to the players and ask them what they think is best, because I do think that the U.S. soccer inclusion and some of the rules that come with having that marriage between the two has helped the league in certain ways, but it's really kind of made things a little bit more difficult. But, you know, one of the things that I was so impressed with whenever the Challenge Cup started and sports came back to the United States was just how accommodating they were to individual player interests. So players that didn't want to come back didn't necessarily have to come back. And by and large, most of the players that wanted to play got to play again. Sorry about you, Orlando. and so I do think that there was some goodwill built there, because I definitely don't think that the MLS handled it as well. You know, of course, there were definitely some players that chose not to participate in MLS's back, but there was definitely more of a pressure and more of a, you know, more of a requirement to go back to work on the men's side. And so for the women's side to be as accommodating as they were, but still to show the success that they did, both from a rating standpoint, as well as just the health of the players and the process of the tournament, I think that there's some goodwill there that the league wouldn't behoove them to ignore that goodwill that they created, and to talk to the players and say, you know, from an inside standpoint, where are we going from here? Because obviously being accommodating to them through the tournament worked. And so, you know, it's the soccer culture and soccer as a whole in the United States, everybody wants it to succeed, both monetarily and just as someone with a passion for the sport. And so there's no reason why there has to be teams against one another between the ownership and the players. If they want to keep NWSL going and doing the right things, I think that the players in the league and both the NWSL and U.S. soccer, they've got to sit down at the table and work together to figure that out. And that is way over my pay grade.
This is certainly why I think women's soccer in this country, the NWSL, and what we'll talk about here shortly, is the most interesting league and, I guess, side of a sport that we have in this country right now. Much like Adam Silver and the NBA, I do think Lisa Baird and Yella Averbush have a relationship that is not acrimonious. It truly, I think there is a weight on the shoulders of both the ownerships and the players that they both recognize and gladly appreciate and accept, that they know, much like you were just describing, that this is such a pivotal point in time that if they're, you know, at a divergence in the woods and which path are you going to go down, very deliberate decisions need to be made now to go in the right direction. Overseas in England, which is the only other women's league that I'm super familiar with, and even that I'm not as familiar with it, other than they just continue to collect some, I mean, just unbelievable talent, especially in the Super League. They seem to have things figured out, and they seem to have things, they're making decisions that mirror things on the men's side, for better or worse, and it seems to actually be going in the right direction. I think the NWSL and what they are slowly crafting and purposely crafting, they can actually choose certain paths. They can actually make decisions that will, again, like you were just saying, you don't, the ramifications and repercussions of these decisions now, they may be felt towards the end of the year, but they are certainly going to be felt in 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years. The young girls that are watching these players now and developing role models, what is the league going to look like in 15, 20 years when they're moving up through the ranks? That is, like you were describing, the longevity of the league right now, that is the responsibility of this group. And I have faith in them. Don Garber, everything that's happening in MLS, not so much. This group I do believe in. So what do you forecast the next 5-10 years looking like? What does the meaning of Racing Louisville and Angel City kind of portend for the future of the league?
Well, Angel City, I think, is going to do so much. I mean, you cannot deny the star power behind it. And I think that having the caliber of ownership that Angel City is launching with is going to do just amazing things. I have a fairly long rant that I won't go into too much on the MLS side because we're talking more women's soccer, about how it's not just the money behind certain clubs that gives those clubs their ability to dominate in certain ways, but it's absolutely the level of influence and the level of association with management and ownership that gives teams like LA Galaxy and Inter Miami such a blank check to do what they want with the players that they want. And so I think that level of influence has been so mirrored, and I feel so bad for St. Louis, you know, like what a great community and what a great soccer community. They're definitely like the blue collar, you know, bootstrap team to come in as an expansion for NWSL. And I love just that we're soccer. Like we're a soccer community, and we're a soccer community because our kids are soccer kids idea, but they've been so overshadowed. So I do have kind of like a love-hate relationship with that, that Angel City power that has come in, because it was definitely an overshadow of the other expansion announcement. But I do think that there is something to be said for needing a blend of both in the league. And so I love that we have finally kind of found that highly influential ownership team that is going to be incredibly invested in women and incredibly invested in soccer in the United States, that I think could bring some really great things to the sport. So if that team creates a flagship and is able to really kind of just bring the spotlight to women's soccer here in the United States, that's a flagship model. And I hope that some of those owners will branch off at some point. Like that's my 5-year plan. That's what I would love to see, is more of those big name owners, more of those big name US players retiring, because that's, you know, I was listening. I will absolutely not take credit for this take. I think I'm going to say that this was Jen Cooper in another soccer podcast that I listened to a little bit earlier this week, but she was talking about the magic of NWSL players retiring for real right now, about how they're actually aging out of the league and the league is allowing them to age out instead of, oh, the league went under, and so now, you know, all of our soccer players are without a job, and, you know, do I retire? Do I go get a regular 9-to-5 job? You know, what do I do next? NWSL is getting to the point where they can retire players for real because they're getting old enough. And if some of those players choose to retire and go on to support the sport of soccer here in the United States, that would be amazing. And like I said, I do think that we need a mixture of that big star power influence opening up shop and starting teams, as well as that, you know, blue collar grassroots, we're finding a place for all of our kids to play soccer mentality.
I completely agree with that. And I think it's a pivotal step that the league had to take to prove that it's a big tent league that allows for different approaches, that you don't have to apply for expansion shot or slot and get the you know, this is how you build a club template from the league office and, you know, just fill it in with what you have in your city. You can do the Louisville, which, you know, almost is like a mom and pop sort of. It's a big stadium. It's a passionate fan base, but it really, I mean, literally the name of the stadium is a family's name, as opposed to, you know, Angel City, which is going to be that very almost LAFC sort of glitz and glam Hollywood approach to soccer. It took a while to get there. And I think equally important is the fact that you're seeing what the trials and tribulations that Sky Blue went through. And I think just as recently as maybe 4 or 5 years ago, if they had really gone through that in the, you know, leading up to that point, the club just would have folded. But, you know, Alyssa and that, you know, management group came in and said, we're not letting this fail. This is worth saving. It's a good market. The bones, you know, it had good bones. And now you're even seeing it in Utah, where, of course, you know, terrible management. And again, instead of just letting it fall apart, they said, no, the bones here are good. The community supports this team. You know, the sale can include the stadium, which is a quality stadium. And you have interested actual big name buyers for that. That is something that I don't think existed a couple years ago, and only again portends amazing things for the league. But kind of taking one step back, or one step down actually, to go along with my concept that, you know, women's soccer in this country is the most interesting thing in sports in this country, because the future is truly unwritten. You're seeing the success. Well, I have some listeners that may not would not say that USL has been particularly successful in their communities, but I think as a whole, as opposed to England and, I mean, countries around the world that have 4 or 5 divisions of professional men's leagues, the USL has proven that there is a stable belief and interest in, for lack of another way to describe it, minor league men's soccer. You know, now we're kind of down into D3 and they're still trying to sort it out, but it's getting figured out, you know, to the point where like there's actually dueling leagues at the present moment. But unfortunately for women, you have once Louisville and Angel City come in, roughly, let's call it maybe like 320 spots for professional women footballers. And that's not much. That's pretty limiting, especially when you consider how successful Division I and Division II NCAA women's programs are. And so at the present moment, and Asheville, where I live here in North Carolina, and we are owned by a collaboration of 6 men and 3 women. The 6 men are just kind of good old local boys who had a great idea, saw an inefficiency in the market and started the men's team. They were introduced to Megan Burke, who is actually the legal representative of the NWSL's Player Association. Stacey Enos, who was on the original women's national team that played in Italy, and Lydia Vandenberg, who has played professionally. All three have played professionally. So it's really this cool collaboration of pedigree and passion. And we have a men and women's team, both amateur. The men had previously been playing in the NPSL. This was supposed to be their first year in League Two, and the women have been participating in the WPSL. And we've been the benefactor, or not the benefactor, but we've reaped the benefits of this lack of minor league soccer for women in this country, because our women's team has had just the roster populated by everything from literal local high school players to women who have played on the U23 and U20 U.S. women's national teams. And even, you know, Jennifer Cujo, who was just recently signed by Sky Blue and made a, you know, fantastic jump from playing for the Ghana women's national team to bouncing around the amateurs and now getting a professional contract. This is not really something you see on the men's side. There's more of a clear delineated path. You know, you play your club travel travel soccer, and then you either choose to go, you know, the academy route, or you play NCAA and summer ball in the summer, and then you hope to get a, you know, USL contract, and you kind of take your way up. Even though I would say there is still a massive problem connecting USL to MLS. It doesn't seem like that's actually a pathway to move up as much as I think they want you to think it is. But what does a minor league system for women look like in this country? Is it plausible? Is the NWSL at the point that they could establish successful, you know, Racing Louisville B, or, you know, the NC Courage 2, and have it compete against some of these more successful amateur teams in this country? Or do you think that that's putting the cart before the horse?
It's tough to say. I do think that there's a possibility for that sort of, for that sort of system to come up, but they've really got to be intentional, I think, about the markets where they try to start this process, right? So I look at all of soccer from two different lenses, right? I look at accessibility first, which is to say everybody that wants to play soccer gets to play soccer. And that's definitely something that doesn't exist in the US today. The price tag for youth soccer is out of control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's something that everybody talks about whenever they have this conversation, where, you know, the you never know where the next big talent is going to be and if they have the bank account to support their dreams to become a soccer star, right? Mm-hmm. And so accessibility really is key, but I think that accessibility also goes both ways. You know, you talk about having that minor league group, and you mentioned the NCAA and what that might do, because really for girls at this point, and I know in the club soccer league that my stepson plays in, the one that I see and the one that I talk to most of the parents, a lot of girls soccer at the youth age really is about college, right? Mm-hmm. There have been times when I'm standing on the sideline trying to talk to a girl in a girls soccer uniform who I know plays girls soccer, and I've said things like, "What do you think about the Dash winning the Challenge Cup?" And I get the what, the who, the, you know, the there's a large number of girls that are playing soccer literally because they know that Title IX money is out there. Their parents have put them in a soccer uniform and said, run fast and you'll run to college, right? And so they don't really have a passion for the game. They have a passion for getting to college. Mm-hmm. And I get that. Like, everybody needs a path. And if that's yours and you can run fast and kick a ball, then go get your college girl. Like, I am definitely not saying that shouldn't be the case. But at the same time, I also know that there are girls that I see on the sideline, you know, little sisters, little, you know, cousins and things that want so badly to play soccer, but either don't have the ability to, you know, pay the bills for two kids to play soccer. Like, the boy's playing soccer, the girl is playing with Barbies on the sideline, right? But also, I think that there's a large number of girls that would like to play soccer, but know that the traditional club soccer model here in the U.S. takes them to college. And I don't think college is for everyone. I am one of those crazy progressive people that thinks that college is for some people, but not everybody needs a four-year degree. Not everybody needs a graduate degree. And I think that some of the soccer programming and some of the language around marketing soccer to young girls is play soccer, go to college, play soccer, go to college. And I do think that there's a community of people out there that go, I don't want to go to college, or I can't afford to go to college. And, you know, say what you want about scholarships and grants and all of this kind of stuff that can get people. But there are communities of women that don't want to go to college for reasons that don't have anything to do with money. They know that they can go to college on a scholarship, but they need to work not to pay for their college, but they need to work to help their family or 100 other things. And so I think that if the market and the marketing were right, we could have a minor league women's team if we could market to those communities that say, hey, do you love soccer? Do you want to play soccer after school? And do you not want to go to college? There's a place for that. Mm-hmm. I know that there are people, especially down here in Texas where I am, that kids will play through club soccer, will play through sometimes academy teams and things like that, that will use some of their parents' eligibility to then immediately skip past soccer and go play in Mexican club teams. Because they're, you know, the path to U.S. soccer, the path to white people soccer is you play club, you play college, mm-hmm. and then you go to the next step. And that's not the path for some people. And so I think that the NWSL would have a shot at creating a sustaining second tier if they marketed to those folks that don't want that traditional upper middle class path mm-hmm. to soccer professionalism, you know?
And this is exactly what I meant by deliberate decision making. I think it's been lost in the pandemic, but one of the last pre-pandemic podcasts I recorded was with Megan Burke, and she was, I just love Megan to death, and she's always so coy. You know, I'll ask about expansion teams and, you know, she'll touch the tip of her nose, and, you know, that's a poor thing to do on a audio medium. But we spoke a lot about Angela Hughley's and USL hiring her to explore options of, it was briefly reported that USL was looking to challenge the NWSL. I think that was not great reporting, because I don't think that was ever the intent, but having USL interested in potentially providing pre-made infrastructure to partner with the NWSL, I think is a stroke of genius. Now, I also think that if you try to use the USL Championship men's model straight out of the gate, I don't think it's going to work, because that model requires you, because of professional league standards, and the second division women's professional league standards are not the same as men's second division. They're actually a little bit closer akin to third division men. So I don't have the standards in front of me, but I think stadiums are only required to have 1,000 seats. I think the principal owner only needs to have, I want to say, like $7.5 million worth of work. It's just a little bit different. So you're not necessarily depending on the larger metropolises with 750,000 or more residents. You can kind of pinpoint smaller communities. And again, you know, this is ostensibly a Asheville podcast, and so we view a lot of things through the idea of living and playing here in Asheville. And I think Asheville is the type of community that would benefit from a team in this minor league system. Because I think, just like what you were describing, you would be leaning into the idea of, we do have a successful women's college here in UNC Asheville that produces some great talent and pulls people from across the state and across the region. And inevitably, some of our all-stars from the area, from Western North Carolina, end up going there. Warren Wilson's a successful college in the area too. But I think Asheville City, who is between their men and the women in the academy system, it's 30 young men and 30 young women, and it's completely free to use. It's a high-level kind of U19 sort of academy that is not attached to any one sort certain league or competition, but is attempting to provide these players professional exposure at this point in their careers. So whether it be receiving nutrition lessons for the first time in their career, or sitting in on first team video sessions and learning how to break down video, again, potentially for the first time in their careers, and giving them a taste of, if you do choose to go to the next level, this is what it's going to look like. But if Asheville had a minor league team here, a D2, or I do think those professional league standards need to be adjusted a little bit, because you look at where the successful amateur teams have been in the UWS and the WPSL, it's not, you know, the Charlotte Eagles, who, you know, have kind of just to put my personal feelings aside about them, just in general, they, you know, they have a storied history and a successful history, but you look at what they are now and they barely pull 250 fans to their games, and it's mostly family and friends, or like men's players from the men's side of the Charlotte Eagles. Even Oak City and Raleigh, which has kind of talented people up and down their management and a loose affiliation with some of the stuff that's happening in the Triangle area with women's soccer, they don't get more than 50 to 100 people out to game. Asheville, we, you know, our first season, we were averaging 1,600. We were 1,500. We were setting records. And then Tulsa, this past year, Asheville and Tulsa were trading back and forth. These aren't what you would consider hotbeds of soccer, but they're communities that have wrapped their arms around other members of their community who didn't necessarily, you know, like you said, travel to go off to Chapel Hill or some of these other colleges that pulled them away from their community. They saw their own neighbors on the pitch and decided to support that. At the same time, I think you were also saying that they need to be very picky and choosy. I do also think you are right that if they, you know, just cast the doors open and just accept anybody that kind of comes through the door, you are going to see that, you know, women's league that existed in the early 2000s that had teams up and down the Eastern Coast that it lasted 3 years and then it just kind of fell apart. And that was not for maybe a lack of player interest, but the infrastructure wasn't there. The commercial motivations weren't there. And I think on the back of the U.S. women's national team success, the current success of the NWSL, I don't know that there's going to be a better time to allow the teams, you know, the cream's going to rise to the top, and to create something for those teams.
Exactly. Right.
So Darby, last thing before I let you go, at the beginning of this month, FAIR came out with a report on diversity and inclusion in U.S. soccer. And this report, unfortunately, because everybody's attention span is about 36 hours and every other day, you know, usually some conservative or Republican is lighting something new on fire and pulling people's attention away from things. This probably only stayed in the, you know, collective consciousness of the soccer community in this country for maybe a week. And maybe that's even being a little generous, but I think it's important. And I think in the year 2020, you know, I don't think anything in this report surprised anybody, but I think it was nice to finally have the collective data and metrics put down on paper in black and white in front of everybody so that we couldn't just debate these topics without having these numbers anymore. And a few of these numbers that really jumped out at me, in the MLS, 58% of players are either Latinx or Black. And yet at the same time, there's only two Black coaches, one Black GM, one Latinx co-owner, four Latinx coaches, and two Latinx GMs. In the NWSL, there's only one women coach. On the USSF board, out of 15 board members, only three of them are women. And in all of these boards and management, there's almost no women of color anywhere whatsoever. Again, I don't think any of this took anybody by surprise, but when you just put it down on paper like that, it's extremely startling. You had mentioned earlier that lowering barriers of entry is pivotal to continuing the momentum of not just the women's side, but I would imagine the men's side too, especially for minorities and anybody who's kind of been marginalized. When you read through this report, was there anything that stood out to you, or was there just something that boiled your blood so much that you, you know, feverishly started to try to fix the world?
But, I mean, I haven't stopped feverishly trying to fix the world in several years, but yet I still haven't gotten anywhere. It's so crazy. But no, I actually, my biggest takeaway from reading the report was I wanted so much to start delving into the bibliography of the report, really, because there were snapshots of things that I saw that I thought, is that really accurate? Could that really be true? You know, that sort of thing. Because while the broad strokes were not surprising, there were a few kind of particularly interesting things that I saw, especially just, you know, honestly coming from Houston, where I know that we have one minority owner in the Latinx community. And we've got someone that's on our front office, kind of lead executive team that's a Black woman. And I thought, surely we're not that rare, but really, I think that we might be. Like, I really had a moment of, are these numbers really right? Mm-hmm. And it's terrifying, especially since we as a nation, we as U.S. soccer, both men and women, there's so much here that could be drawn on. And colonization is one of my biggest, you know, drunken rantings, which is to say that things aren't legitimate until they're white owned, white managed, and using brown bodies simply for the work. And this report really solidified that we are not alone in this. And despite the fact that MLS especially leans so hard on, you know, even our closeness to Mexico and our closeness to Latin America, when they're being someone who has a very close affiliation with youth soccer, and seeing how much they try so hard to get inclusion from the brown communities that live near in and around where I live, it's terrifying that they haven't managed to figure out that the best way to promote that sort of inclusion is by representing those communities on their leadership or in their leadership. And yeah, it's just, the report as a whole just blew me away. I definitely have been kind of working through the bibliography to make sure, because I do believe in doing your own research and getting into the longer part. When I heard that the report was coming out and it actually landed, the fact that it was only about 30 pages, just, I thought, surely there's more. Mm-hmm. And so that's me digging into their, you know, their background documents and things like that. But what an interesting document. And I immediately sent it to that Black woman that is on our in our front office here in Houston and said, what do you think of this report? I mean, I know that she absolutely is someone on a league level that wants to promote these sorts of changes that the report calls for, but I'm just waiting for a place where we can have a bigger conversation. I need this report to light a fire under people's butts the way that it needs to be lit. You know, it's here in black and white. It's not just the way you feel. You know, I think that we all kind of feel that this is the way things are, but to have the numbers and to have it all out here in black and white, there's no reason and there's no method for denying the need for inclusivity in soccer in the United States.
Do you think there would be a bigger change, like immediate impact change, if that happened at a grassroots level or if it happened at a federation board level? Because, you know, obviously Cohn is now our president, but we haven't necessarily, and again, I think everything's been kind of put on pause theoretically because of the pandemic, but she's kind of a product of the system that got us here. I don't know necessarily that there's anything revolutionary in what she has proposed or suggested in terms of her leadership style. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm missing out on something, but it seems a little bit like we're just running back the greatest hits. Or do you think that at the grassroots level, if whether it be state, you know, state youth boards or state amateur level, that we could reach a critical mass that it would just be undeniable at that point that change needs to come?
You know, I think that people look at the pandemic like, well, everything's on pause now, right? And so we're pausing everything. And I really think that that's doing this time of rest a disservice. I think that the fact that this time of rest is happening is the perfect time to say, look, if we're not all really busy with game day operations, let's spend a little bit of time kind of diving into our values as an organization. Let's spend some time looking at these numbers. Let's spend some time figuring out how, once things do come back to normal, that the normal that we come back to is better, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I have certainly felt the stress of pandemic just like everybody else in the entire world has at this point. And I know that things slowed down, but I do think that it can be a time of discernment and that it can be a time of real values reflection where we can visualize without having the rest of the clatter around in our brains, you know, making all of that noise about, you know, that this operation stuff, you know, while you've got a break from the operation stuff, do something about your values. Now, I do love that both the NWSL and the MLS have come out so staunchly in support of Black players and Black lives in general, and hope that is going to push forward some change. I do think that as far as you talk about the grassroots movement, I think that it really has to come from all sides. I think that fans have to hold ourselves accountable to our behavior, what we're willing to put up with in the stands from fellow fans. I think that the players need to be doing the work that they can do, which they have done beautifully. I think that the leagues have got to be supportive of those players, much in the same way that the league needs to look to the players to get some direction on how they should manage the NWSL's affiliation with US soccer. I think that, you know, the league has got to continue to do a good job to look for the players' input whenever they're coming to be more inclusive and more accepting of all different kinds of things, because colonized communities aren't the future generally. You know, colonized communities are what we're moving away from, and the organizations that are going to be on the forefront of the future, I believe, are organizations that can move away the best from that colonized mindset.
I don't know that I could have said that any better. I hope in the same reflection that you're suggesting that businesses do, much like you were saying that fans need to also understand that they do have a power. One example of that would basically be some of the commercial success that the fans have brought to the NWSL. Some of the, but whether it be the Budweiser sponsorship, the numbers that have been driven there for viewers, and now people are seeing that it's worth investing in this league. That's the fans. You know, that's a combination of the players proving themselves to be great role models for us and staunch advocates for women and just the game in general. And the fans have a role to play. And again, I think this is where, on the men's side of things, I don't know that the player or the fans have as much power. I think that's kind of things are set in motion, and it's going to take lots and lots of money to change any course that machine is set on. The women's side continues, if you want to use the metaphor of building the airplane as it flies, this game is being built. The relationships are being built as it's being played. And there's room for innovation from the edges, and there's an opportunity to take responsibility and accountability and make deliberate decisions. You saw it with the situation that happened in Utah with the owner out there, and how one side, the NWSL, made very swift declarations and statements. The supporters groups did, the players did, and then you saw the men's side kind of drag their feet just a little bit and give a very tepid, lukewarm statement that got the desired result, but you could still tell it was kind of done through gritted teeth. This is what I think this moment, what you said, the moment of peace and rest, has allowed us to do. I don't know that would have been done as quickly. The situation most people drew parallels with was the Donald Sterling brouhaha that happened in like 2014-15, and the way that happened, even though, again, that was another situation where that was a known quantity in the league for years and years and years, and everybody knew that the team was owned by a racist owner. And it seems like this was, a similar situation here, where it was kind of an open secret within that club that the owner spoke like this and treated his own players like this. And it took potentially this moment in time in society and culture for us to be able to shine a light on that and, just basically say, that's not appropriate, that's not right, get the hell out of our league. And long may that continue. Darby, thank you so much for taking time on a Saturday afternoon to chat with me. Can you give your socials one more time so everybody can find you?
Absolutely. So my organization, Switch the Pitch, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SwitchThePitch1. And our website is SwitchThePitchSoccer.com. If you want to find me personally, I am on Twitter at Sunshine, which is not at all spelled like sunshine. It is Sunshine. If you catch that reference, yay for kids of the 90s,
Darby, thank you so much. And I already look forward to touching base with you again.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
I guess that's why they call us the Blues. Time on our hands could be time spent with brews. Drinking like tourists, yelling like drunkards, scoring some sunners, we'll win you over. And I guess that's why they call us the Blues.
You've been listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast. Shoot us an email at youresmarterthanus@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @YOURE_smarter.